We know with the passing of one East Chicago council member that there's going to be a Democratic caucus to find someone to fill the vacancy. Tell us about that, and if we have any updates on it, too, by the way.
There aren't any updates as of right now. It was a pretty tricky situation for the Democratic chair, James Weiser. But with, like you say, Councilman London passing away, they had to prepare for a caucus. But before they got that, they had to get an official death notice from someone from East Chicago, whether it's the funeral home director or a city official. They had to get it to the clerk, Mike Brown, at Lake County, before then James Weiser can get that and then prepare to hold his caucus. And there hasn't been any updates since the story was last published.
So we're sitting here waiting for that official piece of paper to prove that he is in most sincerely. We hate to use the old Wizard of Oz line, but, you know, most sincerely dead, but absolutely dead, to be sure, that to be able to get this caucus set up. I wonder if the chairman has at least things, the mechanism ready to go, so that when the official death certificate comes down, that they can actually get started in getting the caucus set up.
Yes, absolutely. I spoke with James, spoke with him a few times. And yeah, he's prepared and ready to go. As soon as he gets that documentation, they'll hold the caucus, and then they'll start accepting applications for potential candidates, and they'll get that all squared away.
I know that the city council members are typically known for being their own personalities, of course. Mm-hmm. What do we know about this one council member in particular who passed on? Was he very well known that you're aware of? Had he been able to accomplish much for his constituents?
As far as East Chicago, the council, he was relatively new, but he was a retired police officer. Mm-hmm. So I spoke with the police chief of East Chicago and spoke with a couple other community members and council people regarding Councilman London's impact. From what I hear, he was a really kind-hearted guy, pretty quiet, but he was also well-respected. I said he was a retired police officer, so he was well-respected. But didn't make too much of an impact on the council just yet. Unfortunately, he passed away a little too soon.
Yeah. Now, do we know of any people that are interested in taking the seat on the city council in his place?
Yes. Yeah, so the rumor, it's actually not a rumor, but people are expecting his wife to run, but we do not know if she'll be elected to the council. But his wife is definitely expected to run. And we'll see where that goes. That'll be an interesting story if that we'll see how that story unfolds and if that does take place.
Mm-hmm. So I said, only as far as you know, that his wife's the only person that is at least thought to be a soon to be announced candidate for the position when it comes up at the caucus. Or are there any other members of the city staff or community members that are interested from his district that would like to become city council?
No, I've spoke with several council members and people in the community, and right now, it's only his wife that's expected. Mm-hmm. Of course, we'll have more candidates eventually, but as of right now, it's just his wife or his widow. I don't know the correct term on that one, but she's the only one I know for sure as of right now.
Okay. So obviously, we'll know better whenever things can be officially set up for the caucus, and I guess that'll start the clock going, so to speak, for anybody that wants to file for candidacy, because they'll know when the caucus is going to be held. They'll have to have some kind of filing period ahead of time before the Lake County Democratic Party, and the caucus in particular, the members of the committee members and from that particular district will have a chance to take a look at the list of candidates if it's more than one person. It's going to be interesting to follow. Thanks for that. One of the other things, Javonte, that you picked up was, I guess a story that you put together about what the communities in East Chicago and in Gary are concerned the most about these days, about not only the gun violence, as has been the case in Gary with the homicides that have been reported there, but just the overall poverty. Tell us about the story that you wrote for the paper about that.
Absolutely. We've had this really very sad, this very treacherous run of kid shootings we've seen. Since the beginning of the year, we had two kids shot in the same night. Fortunately, they both made it in Gary. Then we had a kid getting shot in East Chicago, and then we had another one in Hammond about a month ago. And so what that did is, so when that happened, I started reaching out to community members, some of my sources. And you have a lot of people just talking about the link between poverty, because here in Lake County and even between Porter County, of course, most of our violence occurs in some of the more impoverished areas, which is that Gary area, that Harbor area, that Hammond area. You can look at census statistics and employment statistics that kind of verify those facts. And we just saw, and a lot of sources were speaking with me, and they said there's a link between poverty and this violence, and it's something that's really hard to refute.
when it comes to the dealing with these things, and you've mentioned about this, and we know we're going to hear more from Stephen Lattimore here a little not long from now about this, what's being called the 10-point coalition. That was a session that had an introductory session this week in Gary, and we seem to focus so much more on Gary because that's where, of course, the police department, unfortunately, are the busiest in dealing with of these homicides. But East Chicago has its share of problems. Have you been able to see any coalition, I mean, any correlation, that is, and maybe even a coalition, come to think of it now, that East Chicago is picking up here because of the similar problems?
Well, I do know a couple organizers. I won't give their names, but I speak with people. When these things happen, I reach out to some people, and I've actually quoted some people from East Chicago who also speak to the violence that's happening out in the harbor area. I think coalition, like you said, that's a good word because there are some movements. It's a lot of focus right now on their environmental situation there in East Chicago, but there are people on the ground who are very concerned, and they're also keeping an eye on the violence, like you say, because it isn't just Gary. It's East Chicago, and there are other areas in Lake County.
Okay. One of the other stories that you had on, Javonte, we wanted to talk about here as we get close, very close to the start of the official, at least, start of the 4th of July holiday weekend. Mm-hmm. Concerns about people that like to do their a chance of showing off their skills at the grill and how mm-hmm. dangerous that can really be for some people. Tell us about your story.
Yeah, this was a little enlightening for myself. I like to grill every once in a while, but we had this really vicious fire. We had another one in Portage actually recently. But then also last week we had one in Hammond, and this family, their home is burned down. They had to relocate because, like I said, people are grilling, and there are a lot of precautions that need to be taken. And, I mean, these fire chiefs and chief fire inspectors throughout the counties, they're very aware of it, and they really want to disseminate this message to the public, like, hey, you have to be careful. There are certain precautions you need to take. You need to be wary when you're grilling because, I mean, I've spoken to, man, maybe almost every fire chief, at least six of them throughout the region, and they all say that this is an issue that reoccurs, and it's a theme that happens every year around this time.
Well, I know we have a lot of residents, certainly in the closely, densely packed urban areas that want to put up the grill, and you have to be very careful if you're like in an apartment complex or in a duplex or someplace where you, and especially multi-floors, where you're putting your grill out there on the back, on the not instead of the patio, putting it out there basically on the back steps or at least the stairways. You got to be careful about that.
Absolutely. That's one thing. I think it was the Valparaiso assistant chief I spoke with, and that's what happens. You had these people in apartments, closed quarters, and this particular one in Hammond, it was a wooden porch. You know, that's more prone to catch fire. And these things happen. And there's also hot coals. When people are dumping hot coals when they're done grilling, they dump them in a garbage bag, and a garbage bag or the garbage can is near something. We had a garage fire that happened, actually, as a result of this. So these are a lot of things that are happening. Sparking these fires.
I seem to have forgotten what Smokey the Bear used to say about campfires. You know, you're supposed to drown it and stir the ashes to make sure that it's cold, you know, before you even leave the area. So I might be the same advice you need to give the grill too. You know, those charcoals can stay hot for an awful long time too. We've been talking with Javonte Anderson from the Post Tribune on the stories that he's had in print and online through the week. And let's turn now to Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore, who's covered a few and some related topics that what you've mentioned here, Javonte. Stephen, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
If you will, let's talk first here about the concern here that they have about, and we mentioned just briefly about the 10-point coalition, and the I guess it's a program that's set up in Gary that is a collaboration with religious leaders as well as former gang members to help combat crime and to be a bit proactive. If you will, Stephen, if you've had a chance to cover just a meeting here just another like a day or so ago, tell us what you discovered from that session and how this kind of program is hopefully will help the situation in Gary.
Well, the plan is that they would have church members and people they call OGs, original gangsters, mm-hmm. who have been down this road, and that they go together and they literally hit the streets and they're on corners on Fridays and Saturdays, and they're just out there being peacekeepers. And the hope is that by doing that, they'll give people a sense of hope, talk them out of some bad decisions. And they're hoping also, as the program progresses, to get the business community involved so that they can give these people opportunities so that for example, they won't have to sell drugs. A lot of people, it's been their understanding that not all of them, but a good chunk of them, are doing that because they don't have jobs.
Right.
And if you give somebody a job, then they won't have to deal with doing that. Another thing, too, is just another opportunity for something other than that. They said that they've had experiences. These are the folks from Indianapolis where there have been young people who don't have a mom at home, don't have a father at home, or they're in charge of the other kids. They're responsible for those kids, so they have to find a way to make revenue so they can feed the kids at home.
Right.
This started in Indianapolis, and according to them, they've had successes in Boston, in Oakland, and they've had significant impacts. In Indianapolis, for example, they said that they broke it up into four neighborhoods that this church is basically patrolling, and they said they've been able to keep the homicide rate down for a year. Mm-hmm. In some cases, 2 years. So it's not something where they just go out, have a meeting, and say, oh, we're going to do something about it. They actually have had numerical success where they've actually kept the number of homicides down. So there's hope that it'll work here. I did speak to the mayor. She said it's going to really depend on whether the clergy comes together and does this, because so often you have these meetings after something happens, then the next week there's less, the next week there's less, and eventually there's no support at all. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a matter of whether there's follow through. And from what I saw last night, they appear to be ready to do it and commit to it.
That's great. That's great. One of the other stories that you've had a chance to keep an eye on that we have seen before and has been highlighted, I know that, and Giovanni can probably help us bring in his views on this as well, too, is the situation of the loss of a very important pharmacy in the neighborhood, in the Miller neighborhood of Gary. And a lot of people very, very upset with Walgreens suddenly closing, not much warning, if at all, to people that had been frequenting the pharmacy for decades, and now I guess it came to a head with this with a meeting here not long ago with the city officials and community officials as well as people from Walgreens coming and talk about it.
Yeah, they actually had a meeting, and the actual Walgreens closed yesterday. Mm-hmm. The issue for them was that they had declining revenue. The people in the coalition, some of them include folks with Baptist Hospital, Charlie Brown, the representative from that area, who actually lives in that area. That's his Walgreens. Mm-hmm. And they're upset that there was not enough community involvement. They just got the notice, and next thing you know, the place was shut down. For them, it's an issue of not having a pharmacy close. The nearest one is in Lake Station, so they'll have to go there. Right now, the mayor got the information from Walgreens that they are not coming back. But they have what's called a restrictive covenant where they actually – no one else can come into that property that they have rented. They agreed to lift that, so now they can actually bring somebody else in who can actually locate there. So if they have the opportunity to get another pharmacy, they can actually go in there, rent the place, and start business. And the mayor said that they do have some leads mm-hmm. on a new client that who could possibly come in there, a pharmacy.
Well, that's great. That's great because we know that, you know, that I don't think that there are many CVS pharmacies around in that particular area. Probably Lake Station and some other neighborhoods of Gary might be the closest ones to Miller to be able to. So that might be a good opportunity there. You've got local players in the mix as well too, like Vito's Pharmacy. Vito's is setting up new homes in cities all around. In fact, they're about to open up a new pharmacy, relocating to a nice new place in Highland.
Oh, okay.
So there are a number of opportunities that Vito's Pharmacy might be able to.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Vito's.
So that's an opportunity. So there'll be some others, local as well as national players that should be, I'm sure, very interested in getting set up in Miller. Giovanni, have you had a chance to talk with people since this all came about and since the store now is officially closed?
Yes, we've been out there. We had reporters. They had 27 employees. But the main thing to look at is that you have a place that's been open since 93, and this isn't one of, I use this term loosely now in Gary, but one of the more affluent areas in Gary. I mean, I use that term loosely in Gary, and that's just concerning the people that if this Walgreens can close at this particular location, then what is the prospect of bringing other businesses in and them actually thriving? And that's an issue, and that's something to really focus on. As I mean, we've seen this trend, this motif in Gary through the last few decades of businesses coming and closing, and that is pretty alarming for a business that's been there since 93.
Yeah, I know that the residents in Gary, in Miller, rather, in the neighborhood there in particular, are very concerned about Lake Street and want to see development and redevelopment happen in there. There have been enough businesses besides the now Walgreens closed. There was a restaurant that used to be open for decades. It's been sitting vacant for decades in the area there, too, and they'd like to see some more development happen in there. There are a lot of people that will definitely come to shop and get, in the Miller neighborhood in particular, not only the residents, but other people as well, but you have to give them something to come into Miller to purchase. It'd be something to watch in particular. One of the other stories I know, Stephen, that you've worked on, in fact, we've just had on the air here on our newscast today, is talking about an interesting STEM camp that is now open for students visiting at IU Northwest.
Well, it'll be opening actually at the end of July, mm-hmm. And they're looking for applicants now. It's for high school students, incoming sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and they want to get people start thinking about STEM learning. In some cases in schools, they don't have the funding for that, so they're hoping to get the kids who don't have that opportunity to come and get their feet wet in the STEM learning. And STEM is a big deal because these are jobs that are higher paying. LinkedIn did a survey and found that you can make up to $14,000 more in a STEM job versus a non-STEM job.
Oh, something to think about. Something when high school students are about to graduate maybe in this next year and looking for some opportunity that may involve other than going to college or maybe some related college training and education you can put together with some training into looking for a good career, certainly a very well-paying job, something to look forward to. So I'm sure these students are going to enjoy not only the camp atmosphere that they'll be able to create for them on the Gary campus, but learning as well.
But now the only thing, too, is that, and this is the good news, there are STEM jobs with a BA and without a BA.
Ah, mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily have to get a bachelor's. You can just get that learning in STEM, you can actually get a pretty good job and a good future. You want to go to indianauniversity.edu/STEMcamp. And then you can get an application and apply for that.
That's great. That's a STEM camp that's going to be underway here later in July. We're talking with Stephen Lattimore, who is from Lakeshore Public Radio, and some of the stories that he's been keeping an eye on and covering as well for our news reports. And we've also been talking with Javante Anderson, who is a reporter who covers the cities of East Chicago and Gary and other parts of Lake County for the Post Tribune. Javante, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate you taking time, your first time here on the program, and hope to have you back again very soon.
Hey, thank you very much.
And Stephen, thank you very much for being with us in the studio to talk about your stories, and hope to look forward to hearing more and finding out more here in this next week as well, too.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing on with our Reporters Roundtable, let's take a look at some of the stories here in Lake County in particular that Carrie Napoleon from the Post Tribune has been working on, reporting both in print and online. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get started here with an interesting story with sort of, it's, I guess, a follow-through on a longstanding story of recent date, at least a problem that has been the crux of the issues involving the Lake County Sheriff's Department, in particular Sheriff John Buncich and his chief of police, dealing with the issue of towing companies that do business with Lake County. And, of course, we know that led to a new ordinance that was established by county officials. And how has that ordinance been doing these days?
So far, they say so good. They're still ironing out some wrinkles, and their goal was to make it as fair as possible. So each tow operator has its opportunity to get a tow, and if they, for some reason, can't respond, it goes to the next person on the list. Or if they do respond and another one comes up, it goes to the next person on the list.
Mm-hmm. It's basically trying to spread out the business, so to speak, and, as you say, make it more equitable for everybody that's signed up to be a towing operator?
Exactly. Instead of being arbitrary as to who is getting the particular calls for the tows, it's a system where the 911, when a call comes into the dispatch center, they just go to the next person on the list for that particular zone.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any comments or complaints or problems? I need to say it's kind of a work in progress now. The ordinance is in place, but as you say, the mechanism that helps make it work, so as you say, to make sure that every operator gets a fair chance of getting the business, is there problems or complaints that have come in that you're aware of?
I'm not aware of any. The only thing that I've heard is that some of the police officials, some of the towers who are still under contract through August, out of the original towing companies that were hired by the sheriff, Some reapplied to be part of the program under the commissioners, but some did not. Mm-hmm. And those who did not were given a 90-day notice as per their contract that they wouldn't be used anymore after that 90 days expired, which is sometime in August. Now, some of them, anecdotally, apparently are not responding or not responding. They're just not taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
So when something comes in, they're just like, you know, it goes to the next person. That's the only thing that I've heard that, you know, may have be a little issue right now. But, you know, again, that's the only thing that we've heard about. I don't know if the tours are totally comfortable yet or not. We'll have to see.
Well, maybe because it's a new arrangement, they have to get used to it as well, too. They were used to they had the old setup. And like you say, I guess it's the prerogative of the towing companies, you know, if they want to take the business or not. And they're the ones that know whether they feel comfortable with this arrangement or not. So I can see why they may have to work out this among the other bugs that have yet to be worked out in the system there, too. So one of the other stories – I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there was no tracking previously as to what part of the county the tows were coming from.
Uh-huh.
They had no documentation of that, so it's really hard to kind of divide and guess what area is going to have the most tows. So they might have to tweak a little bit, you know, where people are assigned and how the zones are distributed to make sure that it's fair, but they're going to need a little time to gather that data.
That's a new option, I guess, that they have that they didn't have before with the old setup?
Exactly.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that happens, to see where the calls, you can guess where in some cases the calls may come in, but it's not no officially. Then I'm sure that the not only the towing companies, but also the county commissioners would like to know as well, too, to see how this is all working out. One of the other things that you covered in the Post-Tribune in recent days is a decision that was made to increase sewer rates in the community of Hermits Lake. And it sounds like it's a pretty big jump in the sewer rates there. Tell us where Hermits Lake is located and what is there being seen, what the sewer rate will go to, I guess, once it's officially enacted.
Hermits Lake is kind of an island of unincorporated Lake County within Crown Point. It has been served since it was constructed by its own sewer pumping station and wastewater treatment plant. It's a small plant, but it had its own. Well, for decades, it's been failing. And for about 20 years, the county has been trying to get the city of Crown Point to take over sewer services for Hermits Lake. They ultimately did in 2015 after about $1.3 million in improvements to the facility through a grant obtained by Pete Zasklowski's office. This was a Jerry Hsu project, former Commissioner Jerry Hsu.
Mm-hmm.
And they re-brought it up to Crown Point standards, and then Crown Point took it over. So in 2015, those homeowners saw their rate that they were being charged by the county of $69.71 jump to $86. Then earlier this year, Crown Point is in the process of complying with a consent decree to separate its stormwater. They have to update their plant, and it's a very large job. So they had to raise their sewer rates the first time in at least 9 years, if not longer than that,
That
they've had to raise the sewer rates, but they had to raise them 25%. And they passed that along to their residents and their customers, and the county is one of Crown Point's customers for this community. So they passed that rate increase on to the county, and now the county is just getting around to passing it on to residents.
Mm-hmm.
But that does mean in 2 years, the rates are going up from $69.71 a month to the $107.50 a month.
Wow, it's going to be a big jump. I'm sure that the residents probably, if they aren't already unhappy about it, they will have plenty of chance to be unhappy later when the full impact of the increase goes into effect.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, nobody wants to see their rates go up by that much. It's like a 2/3 increase. So, you know, nobody wants to see that. But again, it was a failing sewer system, so it should have increased their property values now that, you know, their waste, you're not getting sewage backups, things of that nature. So it's kind of a trade-off, but as, you know, as somebody has to pay bills, painful.
These things happen, and unfortunately, it's just happening into a small community within the section of Crown Point that's going to be affected in this. We're talking with Carrie Napoleon, of the Post Tribune, and a couple of the stories that she also covered we're going to talk about here had to deal with the Chicago's lead contamination problems and the visits by the EPA. And they've started in a series of meetings in that community. She was in attendance to find out what's happening there. Fill us in, if you will, Carol, on what the folks that are most concerned about the East Chicago's Superfund site have to say about the cleanup efforts and also about the tearing down of a very contaminated housing project.
They had the two meetings. They had the EPA there on Saturday when the new EPA administrator came, Scott Pruitt. He promised that he would have a more open discourse with residents and provide more access to information. They had this panel on Saturday. It was the first of several that are already scheduled 1 month. That they actually, the residents were able to ask their questions and get answers. And while they still have a lot of remaining questions as to, you know, what is the impact, what does this still mean, some of the residents have been moved from West Calumet in Zone 1 to another home in Zone 3, which is also contaminated but hasn't been tested. So there are a lot of concerns still that linger, but now they feel like they're getting at least some answers from the EPA. Mm-hmm. They did not feel the same way regarding HUD. HUD was a public hearing. They got to make comments about the demolition, but they didn't get any of their questions answered, so they left very frustrated. There's a real lack of information for these residents, and they're very frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Are they feeling not that they was feeling much better dealing with the EPA, as you say, than they have been with HUD, but are they feeling that they're getting answers, or they feel the same as they have before? They're frustrated with the city of East Chicago.
You know, they're frustrated all around. This has been going on for so long. Some of them, some residents, their complaint were they're still living in HUD properties in East Chicago, and they're not getting information disseminated to them. There are a variety of complaints still regarding health concerns. You know, what happens to the long-term effects of some of these children that are testing at super high levels of lead? Who's going to care for them? Who's going to take care of the medical costs? And where are they going? I mean, did you move me into another contaminated home?
Mm-hmm.
And with the demolition, apparently the emergency response was established, or the environmental response was established based on particles in the air. Residents raised some very valid concerns with HUD that they should get answers back on once this process is complete regarding the fact that the actual buildings inside, a lot of them have contamination. After the outside areas were cleaned, a lot of these interiors were checked and swabbed for contamination, and it was found inside. So when you're breaking this up, what's going to happen to the debris? Can't just put it in a landfill, or at least, you know, that's what their concerns are. Can you just put it in a landfill, or are you going to go contaminate something else?
Gary Napoleon is covering, of course, the Lake County Government News and other stories as well, too, for the Post Tribune. And she's been with us here on Reporters Roundtable today to talk about some of the major stories and a couple in particular we just heard about here from East Chicago. Gary, thank you very much for being with us, and hope to have a chance to have you back on the show again soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You have a great day.
Thank you. You're listening to Reporters Roundtable on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable on this Thursday, let's take a look at some Indiana business news. And for that, we turn to Andy Ober with Inside Indiana Business Radio in Indianapolis. Andy, thanks for joining us. Let's take a look first here at the big news about a big settlement involving Anthem and some loss of some data.
Yeah, now this was a cyber attack that happened in 2015. It affected nearly 80 million people and led to more than 100 lawsuits. And this was people's information, including their names, birth date, social security numbers, and healthcare ID numbers, all being stolen. So this was huge, huge news when it happened. And Anthem has now agreed, this has, you know, been a class action suit, and Anthem has now agreed to a $115 million settlement over that 2015 attack. And what is really significant about this is that this would be the largest data breach settlement in history, and it could provide precedent for future suits like this. Obviously, Anthem has not been the only company that has been targeted in something like this. So this money will go to help those affected get credit monitoring. It will help some that have already signed up for credit monitoring recoup those expenses. But this is a major, major deal for Anthem. And so it now goes in front of the court in August, and the judge will decide then whether to accept that settlement. But both sides have agreed in principle mm-hmm. to that $115 million number.
Has any word ever come out since then as to how this data breach happened?
Other than encryption issues, that's one of the requirements for Anthem is to revamp and strengthen their encryption security.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been a big focus of this. But as far as exactly, you know, pinpointing where it happened, at least that hasn't been brought out publicly. But one of the major issues here is, that Anthem will have to maintain a specific level of funding for information security and change some of those security practices, including strengthening their encryption security.
Mm-hmm. And as far as we know, that other than just this initial problem with the data being obtained somehow, or at least the access to it, no problem as far as those who are insured by Anthem, as far as we know?
Yeah, as far as we know, that has not been any part of a major follow-up, which is good news, especially considering the size of this. Like I said, mm-hmm. nearly 80 million people, but, Anthem and others did jump on it very quickly to make sure those people affected did have credit monitoring and were in the know about what had happened. So hopefully that has helped.
And one of the other stories that I know you were covering and we want to take a look at here during a reporter's roundtable is GE orders and $31 billion worth. But apparently the Hoosier State plays a big role in that sizable number of orders.
Now, this announcement happened at the Paris Air Show, which is really the world's biggest aerospace industry event. And Governor Eric Holcomb and a delegation of Indiana Economic Development officials were there during their recent trip to Europe. But GE Aviation announced $31 billion in orders. And that is good news for the $110 million jet engine assembly plant in Lafayette. It currently has about 70 employees, but when the LEAP engine production, which is what they're doing there, when that gets to peak production, that's expected to grow to more than 230. So right now, GE says it has an order book of involving more than 30 airlines and more than 1,700 engines. So this new set of orders not only is obviously very good news for GE Aviation as a whole, but for this relatively new Lafayette jet engine assembly plant. And they invested more than $100 million into it, so they're getting a return on investment there.
That's good news, and we know that that's good news generally for GE because they're going through this stage right now of kind of divesting itself of some of its traditional holdings like lighting and things like that. They decided that they were going to get out of the light bulb business, so to speak, and continue on with these other major areas. So that's certainly good news for GE, to be certain. But you talk about Governor Holcomb. He, of course, was at the in overseas in Europe for his trade mission there. And I guess it's also come out here lately, too, that the state governments unveiled a 10-year agricultural strategy. Tell us about that, if you will, Andy.
Yeah, obviously agriculture has been a 200-year tradition in Indiana, but they're really looking to take this traditional industry into the future. And it wasn't only agriculture heads that were in this, but university, industry organizations, governmental organizations all got together and over the course of a year and a half put together a 10-year strategy for the agriculture industry. And it goes way beyond just what is happening on family or industrial farms. Mm-hmm. Really, this focuses very much on what happens after the food or you know, the livestock or whatever is produced. Two major focuses of this that I think are worth discussing are, number one, infrastructure. And obviously, that was a huge focus, billions of dollars in focus for the Indiana General Assembly this year, but making sure that the infrastructure is there to get this product out across state lines and throughout the United States. So that is a big focus. And also a major focus is broadband access. Indiana has long had issues with having enough broadband and high-speed internet access, specifically in rural areas, and technology is more and more crucial to these agricultural operations being able to succeed. So a big focus of this is how do we get these companies to invest in higher amounts of broadband access in these rural areas so these operations, not only can you get these operations better connected, but you can attract better talent in areas with better access to high-speed internet. So infrastructure and broadband access are two of the major focuses here that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise thought of in an agriculture strategy.
Now, we know that there's going to be a local and county component to the infrastructure increases as far as the roads and like are concerned, based on the bills that the lawmakers passed and the governor signed. I wonder if this strategy also includes finding ways to help local counties deal with the infrastructure. You're talking about getting products from the farms, many of them out there in the edges of counties, and they've got to have a good sound and secure county roads to be able to bring that stuff to market now, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And they talked about how in its communities, ag is such a main economic driver that communities need to be willing and ready to invest. And as you talked about, the state plan that came through in the Indiana General Assembly does provide some mechanisms to help these local governments pay for these infrastructure improvements. So roads and bridges, obviously, mm-hmm. a huge, huge issue when it comes to getting these, the production isn't the issue so much as it is making sure that not only can we get these products out, but also another big focus is promotion. Letting the rest of the state and the rest of the country know what is happening in Indiana, what is coming out of Indiana, and really promoting the strength of the industry here.
Well, it's all good news for those folks who happen to live and work on the farms in rural areas like LaPorte County and as well as in South Porter County and Newton and Jasper counties up here in Northwest Indiana. We appreciate the information on that. We've been talking with Andy Ober, who is Assistant Managing Editor for Inside Indiana Business, about some of the major Indiana business stories of the week. Andy, thank you for being with us, and we'll check in with you again soon.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Let's wrap up our Reporters Roundtable for this Thursday with a conversation with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune. Carol, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And we have some interesting stories that you've had to cover. Some good news, some bad news. Some good news only for folks who maybe have asked to go before the Gary Common Council to get something done and maybe got their wish. Bad news, of course, we have. We'll start out first with the real serious loss of a major region history point with potato chips, in particular Peerless Potato Chips, no longer in business. Tell us about the very, very sad story, which unfortunately we know is related to the problems as far as Central Grocers and Joliet's concerned. Tell us.
Yeah, real tragedy for local snack lovers of this institution. And it has been collateral damage of the Strack and Van Til fallout that involves their owner, the Central Grocers Incorporated, which is in a bankruptcy filing situation. And as a result of that, Peerless has been, their owner tells me that he has not been getting paid. His product is disappearing from the shelves and not being restocked. And meanwhile, one of the possible buyers of the Strack fleet of stores, Jewel Osco, is taking Peerless products off its shelf.
Have they said why in particular? Do we know why Jewel Osco is not offering that brand?
Well, Jewel is probably leaning toward its own brand. I'm not that familiar with Jewel and potato chips, but I believe they're leaning toward their own brand.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I can understand if that were the case, especially with Kroger, because Kroger does the same. You can pick up Kroger potato chips if you go to stores like Food for Less and some of its other stores too. So
Meijer and a lot of these major companies just don't stock the local brands.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
I understand, looking at the story, that it's very interesting. As you say, it is definitely a sad story as far as region business is concerned, but it's been a very successful business, even in its own right. They've made some, I understand, some improvements over the years. They had a very old facility, and they relocated to a new facility across the street from the old plant to try to keep the business alive.
Yeah, they would have made it to 90 next year had they survived this year, and from what I was told by the owner, Mr. Hogue, they were pretty good years until just recently.
Mm-hmm.
So he employed about 15 people, and they've all been let loose. And it looks like they'll probably put the place up for sale. It's on 16th It's on West 11th Avenue in Gary, in the 1600 block. Nice facility.
That's what I understand. I wonder whoever takes advantage of buying the plant or at least the equipment out of the plant's going to have a good way to help build their business, and hopefully it'll be in potato chips as well or something related, to be sure.
Yeah.
Do we find that, I guess, much response that you've heard from shoppers or certainly from other people and maybe some about the loss of Peerless potato chips?
Yeah, I've been getting hit on Twitter and emails from people. Mainly they just want to know if I know where they can find Peerless.
Well,
I don't have that information. Sorry.
Well, I know for sure. I checked at the Strachan Van Til store near me, and unfortunately, there's an empty space on the shelves where they used to be. And now I feel bad. I should have bought up a couple Biggin bags to be sure to at least enjoy for a little while longer.
We'll miss the Biggin.
And we'll have to look for other alternatives. They'll be out there, but nothing will be quite the same as Peerless potato chips.
I know at my family gatherings, they were always one of the staples. You'd see that red and white bag sitting there.
One of the other stories I know that you covered here recently, Carol, was a story that kind of follows through after the recent Lake Station School District referendum. Voters in the school district approved a nearly $6 million referendum, a seven-year program that would help improve the schools. But as I recall, and even talking with the superintendent after the election that day, that he said that nothing was off the table, that the Polk Elementary School could still be closed, even though the referendum passed. And I understand now, according to your story, that's unfortunately going to be the case.
Yes, it is. It is very unfortunate. They never took Polk off the table, but supporters, and that's the parents and the kids, the teachers that went to Polk, which is a very nice school. It was A-rated for several years on Lake Station's east side. They hoped that by passing this referendum, it would give them some more time to perhaps increase enrollment or, you know, increase the tax base to help things along. But the superintendent tells me that the General Assembly's two-year budget didn't do Lake Station any favors, and the cuts that they received in their budget will be made up by the referendum gains, but that doesn't help them keeping Polk open.
Have they been able to find options to be able to move the youngsters that were at Polk as it closed to go
to
other
schools?
Yeah,
they're going to be redistricted. Yeah. Some will go to Bailey, which is north of Polk on the same side of the city, and others will go to Hamilton, which is pretty much in the central part of Lake Station.
Mm-hmm. I understand, too, in addition to the closing of an elementary school in Lake Station, that we've had some, and of course the layoffs of teachers, the 13 teachers that will be losing their jobs that have been at Polk Elementary School, that the Gary Community Schools is also going to have to lay off some employees, and will there be any teachers in that mix?
Yeah, Gary has laid off, as of Tuesday, 44 teachers. Not just teachers, primarily teachers. There were some social workers, counselors, nurses, and librarians, but the bulk of them were teachers. And what is most troublesome is some of those teachers were in what educators consider key areas, which are special education and student guidance. Those, you know, it's difficult to bring in a substitute if you have to for special education, because they're trained to deal with students with disabilities, and classrooms work much smoother with a trained teacher in control.
Do you think that in this case, in particular with the Gary Community School Corporation, that that these layoffs, although they're probably not directly related, but they might be related in what it will be the impending change of management?
Yes,
as the Distressed Unit Appeals Board picks an emergency manager, a team, or individual, that decision should come pretty soon, I would imagine.
Yeah, the Gary School Board President, Rosie Washington, says that the layoffs are directly basically, she said they were ordered by the state to trim down their budget. And sadly, they made that move on Tuesday.
We're talking with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about the stories that she had highlighted in the newspaper, in print and online this week. You also understand you took care of what happened at the recent Gary Common Council meeting. Fill us in on some of the highlights from that, please.
You lost me on that one. I'm not sure what...
Okay. All right. Well,
specifically, you're referring to.
I was thinking that maybe it just may have very been with the school district about that in particular. One of the things, and going back to the schools in particular, at Gary, I guess that there's been a closed school for a number of years. I drive by it on a regular basis from home to come into the station here, and we're talking about Lew Wallace High School there on the south edge of Gary. Mm-hmm. And I understand that they've had some concerns about vandals doing a lot of damage over the years, and I understand that they had a team of volunteers come in to do some cleanup work. Tell us about that.
Lew Wallace has been closed since 2014, and like most Gary schools, it has been burglarized, and graffiti artists have left their mark on it. But the neighborhood generally has kept a good watch on the school. They have a neighborhood block club, and there is a state football stadium behind the school that is still used by the Gary Pop Warner League, and every day you can find people walking along the track. So it's not an abandoned school in the conventional sense that nobody ever visits it anymore or there's no traffic there. There's still a lot of traffic at Lew Wallace. So these volunteers who primarily live in the neighborhood, led by their city councilwoman, Levita Sparks Wade, came out there on Saturday, and they also were able to get some offenders from the county's community corrections program, thanks to Councilman Jamal Washington. And mm-hmm. they were armed with mowers and weed whackers and bags and, you know, picked up litter and did a really nice job. And just in time for Lew Wallace reunion on Sunday, they're going to have a picnic out there.
Well, great. Well, that's a beautiful place to have one, too. You're right. I've been past that big athletic field in the back of the building to the south of the school building proper. That's a very nice place, and it'll be very, very nice to have something outdoors for a weekend event like this one coming up. I know over the years there's been talk about what could possibly be done with the Lew Wallace building in particular, and even I know the superintendent has mentioned that there are opportunities that have come up that she would like to have seen happen inside the building. I guess nobody's really officially abandoned the Lew Wallace building, although we know it's graffiti filled right now.
Hopefully, something with all this publicity and all this desire to improve things in Gary's, hopefully something positive can happen at Lew Wallace. There's been interest in the building, but school board has not sold it out of, I guess, various concerns that they had.
One of the other things that we mentioned about Lew Wallace is certainly the history, and you talk about the reunion coming up here. I know that the students and graduates are looking forward to coming back. And though I'm sure for some, I imagine that it's probably a very, very unnerving time for them to have to come back to see what they remember when they attended school at Lew Wallace and what the building is like these days.
Sadly, I'm sure it is. There are other schools in even worse shape that mm-hmm. – Unfortunately, you talk to some of the Gary folks, and it's become, you know, their new normal that they see these abandoned buildings and boarded up schools, and in some cases the schools aren't even boarded up. You could walk right in. I can think of one high school on the west side where you can walk right in.
Speaking of the abandoned properties, we haven't heard much lately, I know, from the Gary Community School Corporation about the buildings that have been closed and in turn left to having to leave them abandoned like this. Do you think that this will be one of the issues that no doubt that the emergency manager person or team is going to have to take up once they take over?
It is an issue that does resonate with the current administration. Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt said at Tuesday's meeting that she has submitted a plan. They have an emergency financial specialist at this time. They don't have their emergency manager in place yet.
Mm-hmm.
They have submitted a plan to keep the grass cut at these empty schools, and they've also submitted a plan to board up all the open windows and doorways.
The appearances that look shabby and look bad are always worse than what can happen. So that just kind of makes the situation even worse for the Gary Community School Corporation, to be sure. We've been talking with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about these stories that she's covered and topics she's covered for the newspaper here. And when the opportunity to have you here, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable again.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank, too, as well, Carrie Napoleon, who covers Lake County News for the Post-Tribune, to Javonte Anderson, who takes care of cities of Gary, as well as East Chicago and other portions of Lake County for the Post-Tribune. And, of course, as always, Lakeshore Public Radio, Stephen Lattimore, for joining us on Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.